Yo everyone, welcome back to Brand New Techish. We've been gone for a little while, recharging and whatnot, but we're back. It's Michael Behane with
Abba Desi.
Abba, how was your little recharge? Like, just talk about the importance of catching a break every now and then.
Did I go on a break? I don't remember. No, I'm joking. It was good. It was good. My phone broke, which was great because I got a digital detox without meaning to get one. So it was an accidental digital detox. But yeah, it was awesome. I think nowadays, even when you're on vacation, you're tempted to go online and share stuff. You're like, oh, let me just put this on my IG story so people know I'm really somewhere good. And it was actually quite nice to not have a phone because it meant that my concept of time just completely warped. You know, like before I knew it, I'd been reading a book for like 2 hours. I was like, what? It's like, basically, I think I was able to increase my focus and concentration time massively.
That's amazing. Yeah, I was gone for about 10 days and like, and no, I didn't contact anybody, none of my friends, like none of the WhatsApp groups that I'm normally channeled into. And when I came back, everybody was like, it felt like you were gone for like 3 months. And I realized why. Yeah, because like, you know what, back in the day, you know, it wasn't this kind of continuous contact with your homies, like in a group, in a WhatsApp group, in an Instagram group, that kind of light touch, constant contact or a phone call. And when you just disappear for 10 days, a lot of people are like, whoa, where are you? Like, where have you been? Like, it felt like you were gone for ages. So it's really funny how the smartphones have kind of distorted our perception of time. Anyways, interesting, you know, food for thought. But you know what? Since we came back, the last thing we talked about, one of the big things we talked about was the whole thing with the Away CEO.
She was fired
basically for kind of being abusive as a CEO, essentially, to her employees. A quick recap. Firing people for saying stuff in a Slack channel that was meant to be for like LGBTQ people of color. So a whole heap of madness. And it was exposed in an article. Everyone was pissed off and furious. And she stepped down. But now it appears, after the kerfuffles died down, she's back in. So what's going on? You tell me, fam.
She's back. So this is like such an interesting twist in the saga, and also shows you how warped the news cycle can make, like how warped reality becomes as a consequence of the news cycle, because there was a lot of noise happening when she was dismissed. And then a bunch of people didn't even notice some of the stories about when she came back. Like, I saw this news circulating in some of the WhatsApp groups I'm in with other female founders, and I was like, oh, say what now? So indeed, she is back. Not only is she back, but they've now hired a defamation lawyer as well. Wow. Because, of course, The Verge published a number of articles and updates about it. And now they're, they haven't taken any legal action as of the time that I'm reporting this. So, I mean, the article that I'm looking at is from the New York Times about a week ago, but they did report that they have hired a defamation legal expert into the Away team. They have also hired a replacement CEO who used to be involved with like another, what was the brand? Sorry, I need to find out the name.
Was it Lululemon, I think? Something like that.
Lululemon. And the update is that he will be co-CEO alongside previously ousted and shamed, but now seemingly back in the spotlight, Miss Corey. So I reckon she like flung something scary at them and they reinstated her. I don't know what the, I'd like whether she has a recording on her phone of some dodgy stuff that she did with the main investor. I do not know, but she has fandangled some juju out there and I want to know what it is.
You know what? You've just spun me for six. I did not think of that whatsoever. I just thought that basically they got caught in the eye of the storm with the whole Twitter like backlash, but nobody within the senior rankings of the company or the investors really gave a crap about what she was alleged to have done. My opinion is that once the dust settled, it was just like, well, really and truly, that's kind of how, you know, we think a company should be run. Now the PR's died down, let's push it back in because we've got to push this company to IPO and make $1 billion, whatever, right? And that's how I personally see it. I don't even think it's as crazy as you're thinking, where there's some twist. Yeah, I think it was just like, they were like, yo, you know what? Yeah, a lot of people, and there was a lot of people that kept quiet that probably thought, you know what? This is all normal in a startup. This is all normal. This kind of abusive, kind of harsh, you know, tactics about getting the best out of your employees, like, that's kosher. And like, I think once the kind of storm died down, it was like, yeah, let's just get it back in, like, because no one's paying attention anymore, right? And I think I saw a tweet actually that said, like, there's two types of apologies. There's one where you're caught out and you're apologizing, and there's one where you're genuinely out of your own, you know, conscious, just saying, listen, I think I've been going down the wrong path, whatever. And this is obviously, I've been caught, therefore I'm saying I'm sorry. But are you genuinely sorry? Like, do you, hand on heart, do you think that what you did was not okay? And I don't believe it for a minute, honestly. I'm not surprised. Anyways,
I think from what I can gather, similar to your point as well, like, it's also shows us how we as the public can get so hoodwinked by corporations, because from what I understand in the story, the gentleman that has been hired into the CEO role, the former Lululemon exec, was always going to be transitioning into CEO as they headed towards being a public company, whereas Corey was then going to take on a sort of chair role. And we see this happen a lot in startups. The person that gets you there isn't necessarily the person to continue, you know, captaining the ship post IPO. So now in this sort of PR spin that they have us caught up in, they're saying, oh, you know, just because he was going to be CEO and she was going to be chair doesn't mean the actual functions of the role were going to change. So nothing is really changed, except they're just like not changing the titles as quickly as they should. So I don't know. I just feel like, you know, there's so much corporate wizardry that happens, you know, all of this stuff, just kind of smoke and mirrors. You're never really quite sure what's going on. And it's like a reminder to us that companies are going to do whatever it takes to get that bottom line or to get that next milestone and to get that goal. And sadly, that includes a lot of nefarious stuff.
I mean, let's keep it real. We don't even need to abstract it to company. We can just say, like, people, when they see the finishing line to becoming a billionaire, they will do whatever, a lot of people will do whatever it takes to kind of be like, yo, like, I see the finishing line, I'm about to be a billionaire, all our investors are about to make billions. Like, yo, like, if we got to do a couple little, you know, a little head fake and say, oh yeah, I'm stepping down and then I'm back again, like, yeah, anything can happen.
Are you trying to tell us something, Michael? Do you have some feelings in the way?
No. You know what? Actually, this whole story reminded me of something about how much attitudes about the workplace change. So a quick story about me. Yeah, 10 years ago, kind of, so I'm dating myself, I had like an internship at a media company. I don't think I've ever told this story publicly before. Uh-oh. And I got caught in the lift with the CEO, and I was going on like a lunch break when I shouldn't have been going on a lunch break, and I held up the lift for the CEO. Bearing in mind, this is like 1,000 people company. They own massive media properties in the UK. This is a giant big, like, they own a television channel. I'm not going to say what company it is. Anyway, now the CEO looks me in the eye and calls me an effing D-head, basically. He looks me in the eye and berates me. He's like, you effing this, you effing this. I looked at him, I started laughing. Bearing in mind, I'm an intern, because I thought he was joking. I didn't realize. I got off the lift thinking, what the hell was that? Yeah. I come in, I tell my line manager. She was like, are you serious? I was like, yeah. And everyone said, listen, around here, that's par for the course. It's normal, it's legit. Now, if you think about it now, in this day and age, like, you can't get away with that. You can't get away. Everybody has a certain expectation about how to be treated, and rightly so. But just even me thinking back to like 10 years ago, yeah, like the things that I saw happen to me and happen to other people, like, the culture shifted and for the better.
But you know what? Can I just say, I get really upset in those kind of okay boomer moments when old people, I had this recently with family where I was just like, you know, it's harder to get on the property ladder. It's harder this, it's harder that. And then some of my, let's say, family relatives, a few decades older, were like, oh, it was hard for us too. And I was like, well, actually, if we look at the facts, like, it was easier to get a deposit, you know, proportionate to your earnings, savings rates were high, et cetera, you know, cost of borrowing lower. I was just like, let me just pull out some stats here. But then they sort of like immediately went into this very, very common narrative that younger generations are more sensitive. And that to me is like such a great example of internalized oppression, because capitalism is completely based on this concept of productivity. And the more we work, the more productive we are, the more we generate in terms of capital. And what we forget is that we are not machines, right? Like, the diminishing returns to our mental and physical health will come a lot faster than a combine harvester's. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And so when people in older generations see younger generations fighting for basic things like mutual respect, decency, a lack of discrimination along race, gender, sexual orientation lines, people see that as sensitive. That to me is just like, whoa, zoom out a bit, zoom out.
I think it's a real glitch in people's hardware, in the sense that for example, if you say to a white person, oh, like, this is an example of white privilege, a lot of times they'll get their back up and they'll be like, no, well, actually, you know, I was poor too, and I never had that example, right? And they'll always look for a thing. They always
Someone
take it personal,
kicked my dog.
Yeah, exactly, right? Or even if you say to a dude, oh, this is an example of sexism, a lot of dudes will be like, nah, but, you know, no. And what you presented is almost like the age version of that, where if you present to an older person and say,
age privilege.
Here's an example where younger people are a bit screwed. The older person will automatically take it as a thing of like, well, I've got to flip it and prove to you that I had it just as hard. Mm-hmm. Actually. And it's like, you know what? I don't have time for this. So anyways,
check
that's
your
all I
generational
to
privilege.
Yeah, man. Anyways. that's So the other story I want to talk about is, so Casper's trying to go public. They put their kind of S1 filing, which is a document to kind of, you know, present your company data before you go public. And everyone's like, wow, another way to lose money. So like they, I think the revenue, yeah, was 358 million. Oof. They're losing 93 million.
Damn.
Someone on, people on Twitter worked out that like per $1,000 of sales, they're losing like $300. Mm. Right, so it costs them, like, let's say for example $400 per mattress, but when you factor in like you know, returns, marketing, sales, like they end up losing money per mattress sale. So it's like, why, I don't know, why are these like, you don't have an innovative product, you're selling a mattress, right? The market for mattresses wasn't great, but there's a whole bunch of DTC companies doing the same thing. Like, in what world is this an IPO worthy company? Like, I don't see it whatsoever. Like, it doesn't make no sense to me. Like, and I feel like VCs have just burnt money on this product. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of great people that work there, and it might,
yes,
it might be acquired. It might be acquired by a big, you know, a big retailer perhaps. And I think that might be the exit, but like, this is not an IPO company. What do you think? Am I being too harsh?
It's a hard one, you know, because I think if we rewind the clock, not even 20 years ago, probably more than that, 30, 40, 50 years ago, when we don't think about nascent industries like D2C or whatever, you would probably examine a company slightly differently. And I think when you think of a D2C company, you're not only thinking of the vertical that they're serving now, but rather like the whole, I guess, like, scope of what they're trying to do. And I think that like what Casper seem to be positioning themselves as beyond the mattresses, because they've also done these, you know, like napping pop-ups in like New York, and they've got their CBD gummies. I think what you have is a company that's sort of like positioning itself as like a sleep lifestyle brand. And the idea is if they can become a trusted name in sleep, and then also thinking about the fact that like you have like millennials and Gen Z who invest more in experiences, and like, you know, apparently we're the first like death positive generation, so we're like thinking about stuff that previous generations didn't have, so we're investing more in, let's say, our sleep routines and our night routines and our well-being. So I could imagine a world where like they're basically going to try to be the brand when it comes to sleep and develop a like an ecosystem related to sleep and rest. And therefore, like, you know, most stocks I'm guessing you invest in, you're probably not thinking about doing anything with them for at least 10, 15, 20 years, right? A much longer period of time. So, okay, they might make a loss in 1 year, but if you extrapolate over a longer time distance, then they could actually have a lot of potential for growth. That's how I'd see it.
I think when you start talking about like, because they use the word the sleep economy in their S1 filing, and it, to me, it reminds me of
so
WeWork.
Bougie.
Yeah, so just using these bougie-ass fancy terms to describe things that, listen, you're a property company. Listen, Casper, you're a mattress company, right? Don't, like, what's the reality? I don't have time for this BS no more. You know what I'm saying? And I just, I feel like I'm being so harsh, but it's a crowded marketplace. You're selling a mattress. You're not even a profitable company right now. Let's, come on, let's rethink this, please, everybody. Anyways, I don't want to be too harsh on Casper. I'll leave them. The other thing that was mad, in recent pop culture or in the world of outside of tech, is the whole Harry and Meghan thing. So for our American listeners, actually, American listeners probably know, they probably know more about this than we do. So Harry, Prince Harry, and Princess Meghan have like stepped back from their official job titles and roles. They want to spend more time in North America. And, you know, that's all interesting and whatnot, but I've just found that the backlash in Britain around this has been so fascinating. Like, I have never seen a character assassination of someone like Meghan in my lifetime. She has been, for nothing, I don't know what why, okay, I'm gonna say something stupid, right? I don't know why people hate her, but I know why people hate her.
Come on now.
And no one wants to acknowledge that. We know why people hate her. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
It's crazy because I had an argument with like two of my like closest friends about this, both of whom are half white, half something else. So like people of color, but not brown. They're like half like Far East Asian. So I don't know. I think maybe you don't necessarily experience the same type or as frequent racism as maybe like black or brown people here in the UK. But anyway, they were talking about some BBC debate they'd listened to where one of the participants kept saying, you know, this is clearly down to the fact that people have been so racist to her and discriminated against her openly in the media, everything about her, because she's black, they can't accept her. And my friends were like, it's not about the fact that she's black. It's about the fact that she didn't conform to the expectations of what royals should do. They didn't release their baby photos. They didn't do this. They're not fulfilling the role that's expected of them by the people. And that's why people are mad. And I was like, but it's mostly the race thing, isn't it? And I was
come on.
And I was like, we have to be realistic, right? When we read anything in the UK press, if you want to see a footballer that's getting criticized, it's more often than not a black one who didn't even do anything. If you want to see a celebrity that's being criticized, it's more often than not a black one who probably didn't do anything as bad as their white peer. If you want to see a politician get criticized, it's more often than not going to be like a person of color. And I just think for us to always dilute or diminish the role that like racism and structural racism is playing is just doing such a disservice to all of us. But you know, when I think of the US and the UK, the US has a dialogue about racism that's very well evolved and has been thanks to all of the courageous people who have lived over the past decades throughout the civil rights movement, etc.
Yeah.
The UK does not have that. It doesn't have a legacy and a history of public debate about racism.
Right, yeah. And I don't think we will have one. And I say this because I've seen like selected black people go on TV to debate this issue. Mm. And I don't know why they're doing it. Obviously, I don't even know why they're doing it. I've seen people go on like debate Piers Morgan. And I'm like, why are you doing this? People don't care. They're not trying to hear you. They don't want to hear you. Like, nobody in this country gives a F. They just don't. I'm keeping it real. Obviously, I'm exaggerating. I'm probably a bit pissed off. But like, there are people that care. And there are people we care. And other people that are in their right mind that care. But what I'm saying is, as in like, you're not going to convince people that this is racist if they don't see it as racist, right? And I'm sick of having people go on TV and say, listen, we are human. And we're telling you that this is it. This is what we're seeing. Like, when her baby is being called a monkey by a BBC TV presenter, right? Do you see what I'm saying? When she's doing things like patting her, you know, her pregnant bump, and then Kate Middleton's doing the exact same thing, but the headlines are completely different. One's positive, one's negative. Like, we're telling you, like, our lived experience is that whenever you can't put a finger on why people don't like you, there's normally a reason why, like, and it's a pretty obvious one. So, I don't know. Like,
I would love to just recommend that folks check out Afua Hirsch. I think you read her book and mentioned it previously. She wrote the book British,
right. I was actually referring to her because she's gone on those shows a lot. And I'm saying, I don't know how she has the patience of a saint. I really respect her. But that's not me, fam. I'm not going on there and being like, yeah, this is racist. Please accept it. That is racist. Because I don't have the patience for that.
I think for me.
What do you think?
When I found out they quit, I was just like, bold. I had like so much respect for them. And I feel like we are missing an opportunity as a nation if we do not address the fact that some of this is absolutely mostly driven by racism. If I were a mother in her shoes, I would also think, no way am I raising my child in an environment where their mother is being treated this way. How are they going to treat this child? So I feel like, you know, it makes so much sense. And when people say, oh, the public don't like Meghan, not because of her race, but because she didn't do this, because she didn't do that. No, let's face it. She is proudly black. Her mom has been by her side at every moment. And there are a lot of people in this country, they don't like that. They don't want to see people like that in those positions. And they've made it known every opportunity they can do. And I mean, good for them. Let them go to America, build an empire there. They'll still succeed. I know they will.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. Touching on your point about, you know, her thought process behind the child, you've also got to remember that Harry saw his mum die because of this kind of press overreach. His mum literally died being chased by paparazzi. So now that he's got his own family, wife and kids, he's thinking to himself, and it might be an element of his trauma that he hasn't really processed, but he's thinking to himself, we gotta get the F out of here because this ain't happening part two. I was briefly seeing how Tom's shoes, if you remember, do you know what shoes I'm talking about?
Those when those went viral, man, uni, circa 10 years ago, everyone had a pair. That's when they popped.
Yeah, so they've kind of gone bust. Well, they've been taken over by creditors. And this was a company that pretty much pioneered the whole one-for-one model. So if you like, if you buy something from a certain company, they will like donate something to another, to like a charitable thing or whatever, right? And you see so many companies replicate this model. But this is the original. This is the pioneer. And it's the, you know, the harshness and also, you know, the efficiency of capitalism, like demonstrated, because this company, like when I was coming up as a young entrepreneur, there was a few companies that you looked upon as like the benchmark. You were like, oh my God, Tom's like, what a great success story. Like, and I would read it in Inc. magazine, and like to see it kind of spiral this way, it's not out of business, but it's just like, nothing lasts forever in capitalism. Nothing really does. Like, and you know,
that is true. But I will also say this, I feel like when they came to, you know, real viral, you know, status, is because they had come up with this super comfy plimsoll. It was like off the back of plimsolls making their resurgence through like the hipster movement, etc.
Yeah.
And like, I recently was on the Tom site, this is a few months ago, and I was like, y'all have over expanded into some product lines that you do not need to be in. Do you know what I mean? I was like, do they need to be like, and I just think, you know, do what you do well. And I guess they probably like followed some advice from whoever to expand to this and expand to that. It's expensive. Before you know it, you know, unit economics aren't quite working out. Your margins are getting eroded. And then boom, guess what? You're going to administration or something. So yes, I totally hear the point of like how fortunes change. But I also think like we have to remember that there seems to be this almost template of this, you know, how to scale, how to grow. And the reality is like, okay, just because, you know, 999 companies did that and succeeded, what about the 999 million that did it and did not?
It's amazing because when I, my first company, which was an e-commerce business, like there was like three or four websites that I would look at and be like, oh my days, these, and not including Tom's, these would be like smaller e-commerce startups that have killed it and made loads of money. All of them are out of business, all of them. But none. Like, I go on their domain and like nothing comes up, and it just shows like the temporary nature of success within capitalism as a business unit, like not necessarily as an individual in a career, but if you're starting a venture. And it's like, yo, sometimes take the exit, fam. Do you see what I'm saying? Sometimes just take the money bag and run, because this ain't necessarily going to be around forever. So yeah, just a little warning, word of warning to all my entrepreneurs out there hustling right now listening. I read an article about how now in Silicon Valley, some men are now considering cosmetic procedures as essential for their career. Now follow me. Follow me with this. We all know tech is very ageist, right? And we all know that, you know, once you're in your 40s and your 50s, like, you know, you start looking behind you and everyone's like, you know, clamoring after the 20-something-year-olds because they're the innovators, they're the, you know, tech geniuses and whatnot. Now, this article, which is in the Washington Post, is essentially spoke to engineers in Silicon Valley in their 40s who are now resorting to things like Botox,
and
appear to be at least 30, right? I'm going to read your quote from here, actually. So actually said that last year, Google paid out $11 million to more than 230 job applicants older than 40 who accused the company of engaging in a systemic pattern of age discrimination. The older workers alleged that the company used phrases such as googliness and cultural fit as euphemisms for youth, right? So that's the environment that you're in tech. Now, am I going to get, like, is this what's necessary? I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting philosophical debate. Like, you know, obviously women have faced these pressures for years, but back in the day with tech, you could be like, you know, Steve Ballmer and Bill Gates and just be like a nerdy old guy and you know, releasing Microsoft Office. But now it's kind of like, yo, the karma's coming back to dudes as well. And it's like, yo, you got to look young too. And it's almost like tech's turning into like Hollywood. I don't know. What do you think?
But you know, it's funny that you say that tech is turning into Hollywood, because my partner, who's not in tech, always makes this analogy of how, you know, how in the old movies that we watched as kids, it'd be like, oh, I'm moving to LA, I'm moving to New York, I'm going to make it, you know, I'm going to be a star.
Yep.
It's so similar to like a maker founder that moves to the Valley and is like, I got this, you know, unicorn idea, I'm going to make it, I'm going to be a star. And, you know, when you go to Silicon Valley, you be pitched to by your Lyft driver, your Uber driver. Everyone's out there to be a billionaire. And it's therefore not surprising, knowing what we know about all the different cognitive bias that make people like us or loathe us, that people are trying to do whatever they can to get all those biases on their favor, because there is a beauty bias. There is a beauty Absolutely. Bias that's been demonstrated through research. We like people who look nice and we want to work with them. We want to invest in them. We are less trustful of people that don't look good, which is really messed up and sad. Sometimes I just get so grossed out by tech. I mean, I love it. I wouldn't work in any other industry. But at the same time, when I start thinking about stuff like this and what the ramifications are and how so many young people look up to our industry, and at the same time, things like this are happening, it does make me like feel quite sick.
Yeah. And you know what? Like, obviously, you speak to a lot of young people that want to come up to the industry, me to a lesser extent. And it's like, yo, like, you kind of have to give that warning where it's like, this is a great career. You can potentially make a lot of money. But I mean, you're going to see this one day ourselves where it's like, well, it's almost like being an athlete in a sense that you maybe in your 40s, it's kind of slow going, and it's not you know, like, if you're a medical doctor, you can keep working until you're 70 and everyone's gonna, and being old as a medical doctor is actually a sign of like seniority. You're gonna be like, I want the gray haired person to treat me, right? Whereas in our industry, it's like the gray haired person is like, you don't know nothing. Do you know React, bro? Do you know Angular, bro? Do you know what do you know about machine learning, bro? We don't want to hear about COBOL and we don't want to hear about C++ no more. So like, so is that, would that be a fair thing to warn a younger person about? If you, before getting to tech, just know that maybe the pathway isn't as long as it is in other careers.
But then I feel like there's so much contradictory information out there, because at the same time, was it Fortune or Forbes that just recently published an article saying the most successful entrepreneurs are over 40?
Right. So I would make a separation between an entrepreneur
and a tech worker.
Yes, because as an entrepreneur, someone like me, I don't feel that threatened, because I'm like, well, I'm trying to do my own thing, right? So I can be an entrepreneur in my 50s and 60s, right? Theoretically speaking, if I continue to have some success. But as a tech worker, you're much more beholden to the interests and biases of your employers and the industry at large, right?
So yes.
Like, do you warn young people and say, listen,
about how superficial it is?
Yeah, you might have a 20-year run at this. And not
do you know what, actually? I'm going to say yes. And not only because of the fact that as one gets older in the industry, one is not, there's no positive correlation between aging and your perceived value, right? If anything, based on this research, people feel like there's a negative correlation. I'm getting older and people are liking me less. People don't want me on their teams anymore. But I would almost add to that, it's not only the fact that not everything is judged in a fair or objective way or a way that aligns with your talents. I think it's also the fact that, again, similar to sports, although of course it's not the same, tech as an industry takes a lot out of you. Like, when I think of my friends that work in the public sector or the third sector, charities and stuff, I see people who have a much healthier boundary between work and life. I see people whose companies have not integrated Slack, whose bosses aren't on WhatsApp, who don't even necessarily have all their resources on the cloud. So these are people who, when they're off, they're off. And when they're away, they're away. And the converse of that is the tech world, where we have more and more distributed teams, more and more people across different time zones, reachable all the time. And we actually find it a lot harder, I'm including myself in this, to set healthy boundaries. And I think there's only so many decades of your life you can give. Again, depending on the person you are, there's only so many decades of your life where you can like not have a true distinction between work and life, or rather feel like you're not in control of that boundary between work and life. So I would almost tell people to like also assume a limited career within tech just for reasons of like health.
Burnout.
Like, how many times can you burn out before your body is actually just like, okay, no. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, so like, personal anecdote, like, I went on this recent holiday that I went on, like, I didn't want to do anything. And my partner was kind of like, I want to do this. I want to do, you know, the scuba diving and the thing. I was like, I just want to sit down and just like, just lounge, because I am tired, fam. Honestly, like, I haven't had a real holiday in a long time. And I was like, I just want to kind of just be a zombie and lounge in front of the sun, right? And she probably had more of a career where it's less of a burnout culture, and it's more the thing where I've got pent up, she had more pent up energy to do stuff, to do more cool things. And that's when I noticed a difference in, you know, different career tracks. And it's like, yeah, it's something that is worth telling people about, because it's not all sunshine and rainbow. But anyways, exactly. I think we'll call it a day there. Is there anything you want to plug? What's going on, Hustle Crew? Like, what's popping on the streets?
So for all my London peeps, we've got an event coming up, Huckletree Shoreditch, Thursday evening from 6 p.m. It's a meetup. It's free. It's also an opportunity to meet the latest round of Future Startup Now, which is a program that we run for 18 to 24-year-olds that want to break into tech. Michael is one of the lecturers there. So yeah, please get involved. And also applications are going to be opening for the fourth round of Future Startup Now as well. So if you're an aspiring entrepreneur, I want to break into tech from an underrepresented background, you're in London, follow Hustle Crew Live, get all the deets.
Sick, sick, sick. All right, cool. Everybody, that's it for this week's Techish. We'll catch you next week. Yeah, follow us on, use the hashtag, hit us up. We'll be more than happy to get back to you and network and whatnot online.
Hashtag Techish. And we're on Patreon.
Yes, we're on Patreon. If you want to support with more than just the hashtag, you can give us your hard-earned dollars and pounds and help
make podcasts.
Yeah, all pennies, and help make Techish the greatest podcast in the world. I'm joking. Yay. All right, cool. Peace.
Make Techish great again. Bye.
Ah, don't say that.